Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we are joined by Bill Kristol. Bill, thanks for coming back on the podcast, our weekend podcast. Happy Juneteenth Day.
Happy Juneteenth to you, Charlie, and good to be with you.
The president said, I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous. It's actually an important event, an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it. That's so Trump, isn't it? I mean, it's just like he never heard of it before, but now that he knows about it, then apparently like no one had ever heard of Juneteenth Day until Donald Trump made it a big thing.
Our friend Windsor Mann had a tweet which I think he's done before, though, that Trump is particularly bad in a sense on holidays. And the reason is he can never sort of acknowledge them in even a minimally graceful and appropriate way, which is not a very hard thing to do. If you're president, you have a whole staff and they write a nice little statement and you read it or put it out and that's that, right? But he can't do it because the holiday is not about him. And he really can't say anything nice or appropriate or what's the word I'm looking for, deferential, you might say, about something that he wasn't involved in. The narcissism is so deep.
Well, and also the ignorance, and this is of course one of the sub themes of the John Bolton book. I mean, there's so many outrageous things, including the concentration camps, etc. But the theme that runs through, of course, is that how little he knows and his complete lack of curiosity, which is a separate thing, because there's a lot of things that all of us don't know. But it's sort of his unwillingness to try to learn, that's the remarkable thing and remarkable marker of Donald Trump.
Yeah, we talked about this way back after the election. We weren't happy about Donald Trump's victory, but I think we all thought, and I genuinely thought this was possible, that, he might grow a little bit in office, that he might not be quite as bad as we thought he would be, that, the weight of the office, the history of the office, the responsibilities of the office would sort of get to him. And some of those initial appointments, of course, weren't bad. And so one thought, okay, it might be, it was a mixed bag, obviously, with Steve Bannon and others going in there. But still, one thought it might be okay. I think we were all disabused of that thought pretty quickly when he went to the inauguration speech and then when he went to the CIA the next day. And again, in a very Trumpian way, made it about him standing in front of the hall of the names of people who've died for our country, CIA officers. But anyway, it wasn't crazy to think that he might begin to realize that he has to learn a few things and conduct himself in a slightly different way. He hasn't. And now it's getting just worse and worse. And that really is what's striking. I mean, the notion that it's not even a stable, bad level. It's a worsening level with the guardrails gone or going, which really makes the second term just terrifying to me. And I really should think even the most rationalizing Trump defenders who just, hate the liberals and hate us for some reason and hate the notion of saying they might have been wrong. Even they have got to look at this and think, geez, 4 more years of him sort of unleashed with a kind of a re-election victory. So he's kind of emboldened with no one serious around him, people catering to him. I mean, what a nightmare that would be.
Yeah, but unfortunately, they're stuck, right? I mean, let's face it, Republicans are just in too deep to bail out now. And in my newsletter, the analogy I used, because it was stuck in my head, is like when you get a really bad tattoo, you go out and you get really, really drunk, not you, of course, and you wake up and you realize, I am stuck with this thing. And that's the way the Republican Party...
Well, and to use that, I liked it. Yeah, that was good in the newsletter, among other good things that were in it, but... But the other thing, yeah, it's like, and then I suppose what you do, I don't know much about people's tattoos and so forth, but what you do is decide, I'm going to get another one because, if you have one on one arm, you should have one on the other, and you get down that path, right? And suddenly you're covered with tattoos. And I do feel like the Trump enablers and rationalizers are now covered with Trump tattoos.
Okay, so I want to talk about two things, well, a bunch of things, including Mike Pompeo lashing out at John Bolton, calling him a traitor, which I think is probably somewhat unprecedented in American history. Maybe we could go back to Aaron Burr or something like that. Amanda Carpenter's story in the Bulwark about the Donald Jr., Donald Trump things that claim that Osama bin Laden endorsed Joe Biden. I mean, smell the desperation. But you threw out the name of Steve Bannon. Now, that's not a random thing right now. And I know this is kind of off the radar screen, But a Bannon acolyte has been put in charge of the Voice of America, and he's in the process of just dismantling the whole place, one purge after another. Very respected journalists who are resigning or being moved out. They're whitewashing the walls, of little slogans about free speech. And this guy, his name is George Pak, right? Not to be included.
Not George, Michael.
Michael Pak. Yeah, I'm sorry. And this, of course, wouldn't be happening unless the United States Senate had voted to confirm him. But give me some sense, because I know you know some of these folks, what Trump is doing. In a normal world, this would be a huge story, this attack on the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so there are these different institutions, which are somewhat different, actually. Radio, the Voice of America is the most well-known, but there's Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia. I think there's one to broadcast to Cuba. So there, we've had different efforts over the years to have entities that are either part of the American government or supported by, at least in part, by the government, to broadcast abroad and either provide news about America, that's what VOA does, Voice of America, or news about home countries in authoritarian regimes. And that was something that was big during the Cold War and pretty useful, people said afterwards, if you were a Russian dissident or a Czech dissident. And I think pretty useful today if you talk to people in Iran or in other countries. So that's what these different institutions do. The governance structure is somewhat complicated. There was a board, and now I think that's been dissolved. But anyway, Trump put Michael Pak, who I've known a long time, in charge. Kind of filmmaker, it seemed like a kind of, decent guy, not the most, frankly, impressive guy you've ever met, but kind of one of the many people in the conservative movement who was kind of part of the movement and seemed reasonable and fighting against the people we were all fighting against for 20, 30 years. But he went along with Trump. He ran the Claremont Institute somewhat ineffectually for about a year, and I think was kind of pushed out of that, and then gets this nomination because he gets to know Bannon somehow. And I got to say, I assumed he would get in there, and I know him a little bit, and sort of just take it easy, throw out a couple of rhetorical bones to Trump world, maybe clean out Voice of America, because that's the one that got under Trump's skin. That's the highest profile institution. The woman who ran it, I think her name was Amanda Bennett, was a journalist, and Trump attacked her. And she resigned, actually, when Pak was confirmed. So I thought that would be it. He would leave the radios, which, again, don't broadcast so much about America, but broadcast the truth of what's going on in these different countries to the citizens of those countries, Russia, for example. He would leave the radios alone. And the radios are run by mostly now Republican appointees who were pretty hawkish and conservative and anti-communist, anti-authoritarian, and so forth. Radio Free Europe was run until yesterday by Jamie Fly, whom I know very well, who worked with me at the Foreign Policy Initiative, was Senator Marco Rubio's top foreign policy advisor for 3 or 4 years, and then went to the German Marshall Fund, but sort of known in the Washington foreign policy world as a hawkish Republican, Pak fired them all Wednesday night, suddenly, obviously on instructions from the White House. God knows who has this bee in his bonnet about all of these things. And God knows what's going to happen to them. I talked to Ann Applebaum, a friend of ours, who I think has been on your podcast more than once, about this yesterday, I guess. And, she's pretty alarmed. I mean, she's much closer to all this there in Central Eastern Europe. And the degree to which this is going to become a kind of Trumpy propaganda organ, lose all credibility, make it hard for decent people to work for it. It's got a ton of journalists on the ground, people who risk their lives sometimes and certainly their well-being by being the correspondent for Radio Free Europe, in some of these countries. These people are now going to get, they're not going to stay, it's just all terrible, really.
It is.
Totally unnecessary. I mean, it's not like it affects any American voter, right? But just sort of petulant Trumpism, let's put our people in, let's get rid of all these people who once said something nice about John McCain or once said worked for Marco Rubio. And again, for me, the amazing thing, and I know Jamie very well, and I haven't talked about this, let me make clear, since he got fired, but the amazing thing is that where is Marco Rubio? I mean, this guy was, think of this, I mean, just, Washington. He was Rubio's top foreign policy aide, one of his top 3 or 4 aides for 4 years in the run-up to Rubio's presidential race in 2016. He was a Senate aide. Was with Rubio every day. Rubio totally, I'm sure Rubio was happy, promoted him for this job, happy that he gets it. Now he just gets fired. Rubio's a pretty important senator. He's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Has, to my knowledge, to your, our knowledge, has Rubio said a word? Has he called the White House and said, are you kidding me? You're firing one of my top aides who was doing a good job over there. He's been in the job 9 or 10 months. Who said never? He hadn't taken on Trump. He didn't sound like you or me, Charlie, you know?
Yeah.
He wasn't, it was totally out of the whole Trump thing. It was promoting sort of American principles and freedom of speech and thought in parts of Eastern Europe and Russia. And where are these? I mean, the cowardice of the Republican senators, and this, you know, about someone they knew, an aide of theirs, is really extraordinary.
Well, it does make you wonder whether there is such a thing as a really powerful Republican senator anymore. Yeah. Okay, so I want to back into some of the things that are going on, including the sort of desperation and panic that I think you feel is setting in right now. Latest poll from Fox News of all people, showing Joe Biden widening his lead now 50 to 38, 12-point lead. That's up from 8 points. That's consistent with a number of other polls. The folks at 538 have a new weighted polling average showing Biden up nationally by 9. Of course, we understand national polls are not as important as the swing state polls. But, you know, I think the pattern is pretty clear that things are slipping away for Donald Trump. I mean, maybe the economy will come around. Maybe Joe Biden will commit a tremendous gaffe. Maybe the left will completely lose its mind and in its wokeness. But you kind of get the sense that people are paying attention and that they're seeing this. And for Republicans kind of hoping that the president is going to clean up his act, that's not what I'm seeing. In fact, let's talk about Amanda Carpenter's piece in The Bulwark today. That was amazing yesterday. Donald Trump Jr. sitting down with the president, and I put this in the category of panic, desperation. They're now trying to throw up against the wall the notion somehow that Osama bin Laden was a Joe Biden fan. I mean, really, what the hell, Bill?
Yeah, no, I mean, Amanda's piece is excellent on this, and I give her credit for being like outraged when everyone else is just now taking these things for granted, that of course you would run an ad that says that Osama bin Laden, responsible for the death, obviously, of 3,000 Americans and more, obviously, indirectly in a sense, is supporting one of the two candidates. And you would say it as president and you'd put up an ad. It wouldn't be one of these things where a third party might do an ad that intimates or says this person's policies are softer on terrorism or something that's more traditional, the fringes of American politics. But this is the president of the United States saying that Osama bin Laden, I mean, supports his opponent, who was vice president for 8 years. Incidentally, and whatever, again, you think of his vice presidency, I voted against him twice for vice president, but whatever you think of the Obama-Biden administration, they did kill bin Laden. You know? So, I mean, that's not it's a little ridiculous.
Footnote. Yeah.
But then at the same time, then I guess a little bit later, almost about the same time last night, Pompeo, the State Department, put out a statement. Again, this wasn't a personal remark by Pompeo. It wasn't in an interview. It was an official statement put out by the State Department, which he just in passing, three sentences, disputing Bolton's book, not disputing any actual event Bolton narrates, but just saying it's full of half-truths and lies, and says and calls Bolton a traitor.
A traitor.
And Secretary of State, I mean, in modern times at least, ever called a national security advisor with whom he had just served 17 months, a traitor? I mean, it's, I would call it McCarthyism, but it's sort of, it's as if Joe McCarthy were Secretary of State and were not just attacking Alger Hiss and even people he shouldn't have attacked. Hiss was right about, but others who he shouldn't have attacked, but then calling him as Secretary of State, not as a senator, not as a politician, not as a campaigner, as Secretary of State, calling the former National Security Advisor to the president a traitor. I mean, and of course, needless to say, a totally insane and unjustified charge. I mean, that's the kind of reckless level we're now at in Trumpist rhetoric.
Yeah, this is the statement. It is both sad and dangerous that John Bolton's final public role is that of a traitor. That is extraordinary. Now, by the way, notably, Pompeo doesn't actually deny Bolton's story that Pompeo once passed him a note saying that Trump was so full of shit during a meeting with Kim Jong-un. So he doesn't actually deny that. This strikes me as more about Mike Pompeo wanting to repair any possible damage that the book might do to his relationship with Trump. I mean, he's done a pretty good job, at least in his own mind, of allowing no daylight between himself and Trump. And then this book comes out in which, you know, he's portrayed as kind of rolling his eyes. And we know how that plays in Trump's mind. I mean, you know, Rex Tillerson was dead man walking the moment that report came out saying that he was an effing moron, right? I mean, so Pompeo is sweating this one. Okay, so let me talk about the John Bolton book, because you wrote a piece, you know, that you can say a lot of things about him, a lot of negative things about him, but John Bolton generally tells the truth. So I want to cut to the real chase on this, Bill. If John Bolton had, in fact, testified in the impeachment hearing, if he had not waited to publish the book, if all of this had come out in December or January, would it have made a difference in the ultimate outcome of the impeachment proceedings? Would it have changed any Republican votes in the Senate?
I mean, I think the answer is probably no, but of course one doesn't know for sure. And it is, remember back to the House when they were impeaching Trump and how big a deal the Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testimony was. And they, of course, both worked for Bolton, and they mentioned Bolton in their testimony. Fiona Hill famously is the one, I believe it was she, who said that Bolton had said, stay away from this drug deal. And
yes,
you need to go talk to the White House counsel to make sure we're not, you know, getting involved, dragged into something terrible here. If Bolton had personally said, you know what, Fiona's telling the truth, and I'm going to come forward and compliment that testimony, I know a lot more than she does about the president's personal involvement in this. I don't know. You know, could it have hit critical mass and suddenly, you know, these things are always, it wouldn't have made a difference until it did make a difference. And I don't know that it would have, but I don't rule out that it could have made a big difference. So I'm very critical of Bolton for keeping quiet. I mean, George Conway wrote a piece in which he said Bolton kind of really didn't want to testify, but he wanted the Senate to subpoena him, and he assumed they would, and that would get him off the hook somehow. But it was not a moment of courage or honestly, forthright patriotism for Bolton. And I think critics of Bolton are totally entitled to point that out. But as I also pointed out, I didn't point this out in the piece in the Bulwark, but I pointed out this morning, I think on Twitter, that, you know, liberal critics can say whatever they want about Bolton, and, you know, there's plenty to criticize, I suppose, in his career and maybe in his character even. And the book, I gather, is very kind of self-satisfied about everything mm-hmm. he did, not much self-criticism or self-examination about his serving with this man who he portrays as so incompetent and kind of corrupt and
unfit,
et cetera. But having said all that, the book is the book. I mean, it's one thing to have Bob Woodward write such a book. It's another thing for second and third tier aides to write a book like that. This man was the national security advisor to the president of the United States, was with him pretty much every day for 17 months, is an honest person and, you know, isn't making things up. It's ridiculous. And wrote this book. So I think it's a pretty big deal.
It is a big deal. And I'll just step back for a moment. And I know it's dangerous to use the term unprecedented because there's always an historian that will point out that we'll know this happened. But I'm trying to think of a time when a sitting president had this many senior members of his administration coming forward in various formats and saying this man is a real clear and present danger to the Republic, that he is unfit for office. And we're not talking about just hangers on like Omarosa, you know, or Scaramucci or people like that. We're talking about the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor. Maybe at some point we'll be hearing from Rex Tillerson, who knows? But the former Chief of Staff, John Kelly, the number of generals who have spoken out. This is an interesting moment. And, you know, we've asked this question over and over and over again, somewhat futilely over the last 3 years. You know, what will it take? When will the dam break? You get the sense now that people are, in fact, coming forward, that this is the moment. General Mattis's statement, now John Bolton, the willingness of the sitting Secretary of Defense to push back on the president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, et cetera, et cetera. It's a longer list. A high-ranking official in the State Department resigned yesterday in protest of some of the president's comments on race relations. So, I feel like we've said this again and again, but this does feel like there's a new willingness of people to say, okay, I can't rationalize silence any longer. This is it. I gotta say something.
No, I think I think there's some of that. I think that State Department resignation by that young woman who is an African American, I think she's only 30, is assistant secretary for legislative affairs. I've never met her. I gather she's very well thought of. And she really was part of the Trump team from the beginning. You know, she worked, I think, in the White House, and she did the confirmations. You can see her picture, her photo in the photos of the Gorsuch confirmation and other such, you know, high profile fights in the first couple of years. She was the person who helped shepherd those people through the Senate. And then she went over to the State Department, and she's nice about Pompeo in the statement, but she says she just can't stay in this administration. Katie Wheelbarger, who is I've known for years, who worked on the Hill on intelligence matters, was in this Defense Department for Mattis and then stayed on and has been, you know, in the Trump administration doing her best. I think her views are much more closer to those of Mitt Romney or John McCain, but doing her best to keep the alliances functional and that kind of thing. She, I saw, just either was fired or resigned, I think, in the last 24, 48 yeah. hours. I haven't really had a chance to read that story. I caught my attention because I know her a bit. And so I do think they're sort of at the second and third tier. If, you know, there's people are just finding they just can't tolerate it anymore. Plus, of course, as we saw with Radio Free Europe, as we were discussing, there's also more of a purge mentality from the White House. So it's getting worse. It's getting worse. And so the dam never quite breaks. But I mean, as you said just a minute ago, going from 5 or 6 points down to 9 points down, if that's a kind of where we are now, 9, 10 points down, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, you know, Trump lost by what, 2.5 points in the popular vote in 2016. There are plenty of studies that show if he could stay within 3%, maybe even 4% in the popular vote, he could win the Electoral College. He was down by 5, maybe 6. So he was teetering below where he had to be. But of course, you can make up 2 or 3 points. If you're at 9 or 10, if this were to hold till Labor Day, that's a pretty big thing to try to make up as an incumbent president. So I do think he's paying some price for obviously his handling of the pandemic, the economic follow-on consequences of that, and then the exacerbating of race relations and the failure to be responsible in dealing with that. All of that together has clearly damaged him. And now I think Mattis and Bolton probably sort of helping. Someone had a good formulation in a conversation I was having last night about this. He says it's not really going to change. Bolton's book won't change anything. But for those who were wobbling already and had already sort of decided, maybe not again, maybe the kind of people we featured in the Republican Voters Against Trump ad, you know, the people who reluctantly voted for Trump last time, but have already thought, I don't think I can do that again. I think Bolton puts kind of an exclamation point on that. He probably firms up those 2 or 3 or 4% who are moving, you know, which is what accounts for the 6% to the 9% move.
I think it's the cumulative weight of it. And a lot of these comments, especially from the generals, I think really cuts at Trump's brand. It goes to his whole posturing as being the strong man and undermines it. By the way, the woman we're talking about is named Mary Elizabeth Taylor, and she is one of the highest ranking black officials in the Trump administration. And she said that Trump's actions cut sharply against my core values. This is one of the sharpest resignation on principles that we've seen in the administration. And again, does it actually make a difference? Only on the margins. But again, this is an election that is decided on the margins. Okay, so one of the big stories of the week, of course, is the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court handed Donald Trump one defeat after another. And of course, he's lashing out, including one tweet where he says, "You get the impression that they don't like me," of course, because everything's about him. As opposed about the law. And then he followed this up with a much more violent imagery, saying that the decisions on gay rights and on DACA are, this is his term, are shotgun blasts into the face of people that are proud to call themselves Republicans or conservatives. We need more justices or we will lose our Second Amendment and everything else. So he thinks that he can play this 2016 card, and you and I both know how incredibly important this whole question of Supreme Court justices has been to conservatives rationalizing their support. So give me your sense of how this week's decisions cut into Trump's strategy.
I mean, he thinks he can play that card again, and maybe he can to a degree. There's a lot of unhappiness among conservatives, and some of it may be legitimate about those two decisions. I would say this. Both decisions are statutory interpretations, one of the Civil Rights Act of 64, Title VII, the other of obviously whether, well, the second, I guess, isn't really statutory. It's an administrative law issue of whether the Trump administration followed the procedures of the Administrative Procedure Act. So ultimately it is statutory in repealing President Obama's grant of DACA. Both can be fixed by Congress. I mean, if there were majority, and incidentally, Trump could have done DACA. I don't believe Trump's even in favor of sending them back at this point, at least nominally. I've heard different things from different people in that administration. Remember, he had a chance to do a deal, the wall for DACA, basically, and he walked away from it in 2017. So
and the polls are overwhelming on this issue.
I mean, right. So whatever you
overwhelming,
think.
Yeah.
Of Roberts, who I think was probably trying to avoid a big, do a very narrow decision and kind of kick the can down the road, which is really what's happened here. They can go back and try to do the administrative action again. I mean, basically, Congress can resolve this and probably will, actually, if Biden wins, by just saying, no, we're now going to, whatever you think of what Obama did, maybe that was an overreach. Here's what the legislation should be on DACA. And again, Trump walked away from a deal on that, on DACA and the wall. And on the other matter, on whether you can fire people for being gay or transgender and so forth, and the possible religious liberty implications of that, which aren't, which are real, I think conceivably. Again, Congress can act. Congress can say, there's the Religious Freedom Act, there's Title VII, here's how Congress want those to interact. Here's there is a religious exemption in Title VII. What religious conservatives what conservatives are generally concerned about is that going to be interpreted narrowly or broadly? That's the Hobby Lobby case and all this. Again, these things have been thought about a long time, and Congress can act on them. So there, too, if Trump were serious, he would say, look, we need to pass the way Congress passed RFRA, that's the Religious Freedom Act, after a Supreme Court decision, ironically written by Scalia, that was regarded as adverse to religious liberty.
Yes.
But it was fine because there was no constitutional problem, and Congress was allowed to give religious employers or religious employees in that case. I think it was more freedom, more ability to follow their conscience. But it just had to be Congress had to specify it, and that would be the case if Trump had a serious administration. There'd be legislation on the Hill. They'd be debating it. He'd be making the case for why these following religious liberties are somewhat at risk now because of this decision. But again, there's not even an attempt to make that case. And generally, I've been amazed by the kind of conservative response. There's no attempt to make a serious argument. It's all just screaming and yelling. In the case of the firing of gay or transgender people or people who advocate for same-sex marriage and that sort of thing, and whether a Catholic school would have to hire such a person and all that. Again, there's a lot of literature. I mean, it's not like people have been thinking about this for a long time. There's legislative solutions you could push for. They're not doing so. And again, I think 24 states had passed their versions of non-discrimination against gays, about half the country. Presumably there's empirical data to see whether, and it may be, I mean, the religious liberty is a little more constricted in those states than in states that don't have such legislation, where there are probably cases where, like in Colorado with the Bakers, where there's been a tension between the two. And again, a serious political movement would say, okay, look, here's what we need to do to make sure to bend over backwards if you want to preserve religious liberty. But that's not been the tone, not only of Trump, but of the conservative movement is so degenerated that you have people just screaming and yelling about how horrible Justice Roberts or Justice Gorsuch are.
Well, it's because they really have fallen into the trap of just seeing it in terms of results. They just want they want the results. Whatever the law actually is here. So,
What's interesting, Charlie, they want the results, but the results aren't even real results. That is, I mean, they want to win because the left is on the other side. Most of them don't really want to send the DACA people back. I don't think, even on the kind of screaming and yelling Trumpist right. And most of them, to be fair, probably don't want to fire, I don't think, gay employees because they're gay. Now, they have some legitimate concerns in both cases. But again, the way they're comporting themselves, and this is why it hurts them politically, I think, a lot, or why Trumpism hurts conservatism politically. If you're a normal person and you look at this, you think, gee, I guess the conservative movement's position is every DACA person should be sent back forthwith. And every employer, no matter what the circumstances, should be able to fire someone who it turns out is gay. That's what the conservative movement's position looks like. It doesn't look like, hey, we've got to be careful about religious liberty. hey, we don't want presidents unilaterally doing things that Congress should be doing. And I think that in that respect, you and Jonathan Last and everyone who argued from the beginning that Trumpism would be extremely damaging to conservatism are being totally vindicated at this moment.
Actually, it's even worse than I expected. So the president will be having his rally in Tulsa tomorrow. And I wonder how many Republicans are looking at that thinking this is going to be good. This will turn things around. The president tweeted out about a half an hour ago, any protesters, anarchists, agitators, looters, or lowlifes who are going to Oklahoma, please understand you will not be treated like you have been in New York, Seattle, or Minneapolis. It will be a much different scene. Notice the way he conflates protesters and looters. This is kind of a throwback, but I don't think there's any mystery about the kind of strategy that the president will have. Anyone who thinks that the president's going to tweet less or that he's going to somehow be the uniter or show more compassion just has not been paying any attention.
I mean, I hadn't even seen that. I guess that came up just when we went on the air right here, but this Friday morning. But I mean, think about that for a minute. The president of the United States, what does it even mean? I mean, your constitutional rights are the same in New York or Minnesota or Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, to be fair to the Tulsans, the Oklahomans, I believe the governor of Oklahoma and the mayor of Tulsa would say the same thing. In fact, I believe, you know, it's not as if these are not American cities, and they also have commitments to free speech and to protest. Now, obviously, they could be, you know, various limitations on protest. When the president comes, they'll keep people at a reasonable distance, and there'll be safety concerns with the Secret Service. Trump, not only is it unbelievably, you know, kind of authoritarian in spirit for Trump to tweet such, to threaten basically people in that way, he doesn't even have the authority to do so. I mean, he's not running the Tulsa Police Department. What he is doing is encouraging his supporters to, you know, go beyond the law. Maybe he's encouraging some rogue policemen down there to sort of take things into their own hands because Trump would approve of them and the public opinion would back them up. So it's the worst kind of lawlessness, really, to say something like that. I mean, it is the responsibility of the mayor of Tulsa, the Tulsa police chief and so forth, to keep the peace and to respect people's rights. And, of course, to protect the president and the rally goers, too. But that's not what Trump is saying.
No, that's not what he's saying. Okay, so one major political development in the last 24 hours, Amy Klobuchar is now withdrawing her name as a possible vice presidential nominee, running mate with Joe Biden. I thought she would have been a perfect running mate. I was kind of on Team Amy, I'll be honest about that. I thought that, but of course, things have changed. And she very specifically said the time has come for Joe Biden, wants Joe Biden to name a minority woman to the ticket, which obviously would rule her out, but also collateral damage here, Elizabeth Warren. So what do you think about that? Amy Klobuchar saying, I'm out.
I'm pretty convinced that she doesn't put out such a statement without checking with Joe Biden or the Biden campaign first. Obviously, I think we even know that they spoke the other night, which tells me that the Biden campaign was comfortable with her, or maybe wanted her actually, to sort of make clear that it's going to be a minority woman, maybe probably an African-American woman, I assume. I don't think she quite says that. And which means that Biden has made up his mind that I don't know that he's made up his mind among the different candidates, but that he's made up his mind that in light of, I take it, recent events, that he really wants to have an African-American woman. So I don't think, I guess my only point would be that I think some of the commentary about it has been, well, this is Amy Klobuchar is taking, you know, is getting revenge on Elizabeth Warren. Maybe some of that's going on too, but I think basically the Klobuchar statement should be taken as a Biden statement is my sense.
No, I think that that's true. Do you have a sense of who the front runner is? I know there was a lot of speculation, including in the Bulwark, that it might be Val Demings from Florida. I think the conventional wisdom has been that it's more likely to be Kamala Harris. Any thoughts?
No, I agree. I think there'll be a lot of interest in Val Demings, in Mayor Bottoms of Atlanta, in maybe Governor Lujan Grisham of New Mexico, who seems quite impressive, I would say, and would be obviously a Hispanic woman, a Latino woman on the ticket for the first time. But I think they... It's just so easy to default, I think, to a senator who's been an attorney general of a large state, whatever her problems and her record, they've sort of been litigated. She ran for president. She didn't, wasn't a good candidate for president. But on the other hand, she wasn't like, didn't blow up in some way, you know, she just wasn't terribly, didn't quite catch on. And so I guess I would think they will, I might prefer personally Demings or Bottoms or Lauren Grisham, but I suspect that Kamala Harris will end up looking like the safe pick. And if you're ahead in a race, you usually make a pretty safe pick. Obama took Biden in very much the same way. Remember, Biden had run a kind of terrible actual campaign in 2008 too. And he just thought, you know what? An old person who senator who's been around a while and who has foreign relations policy experience. I think the opposite with Biden. I've been around a while, someone younger who appeals to a different constituency in the party and is, you know, an experienced campaigner from a big state. I think the Harris thing will be the Harris. I think Harris will be, I don't mean to be too negative about her, but I kind of feel like she's the sort of obvious default. One point, my friend John McConnell made this point to me the other day, with the exception of Ferraro in 84, the Democrats have nominated a senator for vice president at every convention since 1940. It's funny, the Republicans pick governors, they pick Mike Pence, they pick Jack Kemp, they pick Dick Cheney, former cabinet secretaries, they pick George H.W. Bush in 1980, a former CIA director and former congressman. The Democrats pick senator after senator after senator. I don't know if it's because they were more of a federal national party or who knows why. Maybe it's just an accident, honestly, but it is striking that that's been the case. And so that also would suggest that, you know, Biden was a senator and he'll think, gee, you know, senator's a pretty good preparation for being a vice president.
No, I see it the same way. And Kamala Harris becomes the safer choice because she has had that national experience and she has been vetted. The one thing he doesn't want is for the VP pick to be the big, you know, too big a story, to overwhelm the particular narrative that he's pushing out right now. I think that he can do that. Okay, so one final word here. I know you're a big student of history. And I was thinking about this in our earlier conversation about The Voice of America. Two books. I don't know whether you run across them. They are just fantastic. One's called The Splendid and the Vile, the new book by Eric Larson about Winston Churchill and the Blitz, which I've actually talked about on this program because James Carville was also reading it when we talked about it. Highly recommend it. There's also, this is not a new book, Lynn Olson's book, Last Hope Island. Which sounds like it's about Britain, but it's really about all of the other allies and many of the stories that I think haven't been told. You know, the heroism of the Poles, the heroism of the French Resistance, and others, in a way that frankly does not always cast the British and the Americans in the best possible light. In fact, there's a lot of times when you will really cringe about it. But one of the things that really comes through was the importance of the BBC during World War II. You know, putting out the news and the information to the world, particularly people in occupied Europe. And one of the decisions the BBC had to make was, are we going to be a propaganda arm for the British government, or are we going to build credibility by always telling the truth? And it's one of the decisive moments in British history where they went from basically just reading memorandums given to them by the government to saying, you know what, we need to have people believe us. So we will give you the bad news so that when the news is good, the people will pay attention. And I was thinking about that as we're watching the Trump administration dismantle Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America, basically deciding that they want to turn it into probably a propaganda arm for the administration at the expense of the credibility. You know, what an opposite direction we are going right now from where the British went at the beginning of World War II. So I would just strongly recommend those if you want some great summer history reading, The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson and Lynn Olson's book, Last Hope Island. These are just fantastic books.
That's so interesting. I mean, you should write that up first of all as a bulwark piece. That's a very good point about the comparison. I ordered The Splendid and the Vile after hearing about it from you and others, and I look forward to reading that. I haven't known about the Lynn Olson book, and maybe I'll get that too, and it can add to my pile of unread books, but I should read them. I've read other things by her. I think she wrote the book about, am I wrong, about Churchill's kind of supporters in the 1930s, the young not Young Turks, but it was something
I know that book. Yeah, yeah. No, I remember that.
By her. I may have that confused.
Well, no, you may be right. And also she wrote The Angry Days about the isolationist movement.
Yes, maybe that's what I'm thinking of, but I know she's sure. written about that period. And it's funny that you mentioned the BBC. I just was, I started it all, but I, like everyone else, I read a little bit. And so 80 years ago this week was the, De Gaulle flees France as Pétain basically arranges for surrender, which I think happens next week. I mean, like June 22nd, something like that, maybe a little after. And De Gaulle broadcasts from London to France. On the BBC, this famous, you know, two-minute long broadcast where he appeals to the French people and says, I'm De Gaulle. It's very De Gaulle-like. Right? I, De Gaulle, I'm here in London. France has not lost. France has lost a battle, but not a war. You know, it's very wonderful to listen to. My rudimentary French, I kind of understand it. It's pretty moving, really. But I think the whole story of the resistances, including the French, but others, which is a complicated story in so many places.
Yeah,
America and Britain weren't always able to help them as we probably should have, or could have, maybe. It's hard to know in a war, of course. So I'd like to read about that. But yeah, the point about the BBC is really a good point. But again, that would require having a serious, government that wants to actually accomplish things in foreign policy, instead of beating its chest occasionally. I'm very curious to see about this Australia cyber attack. I mean, we have a treaty defense relationship with Australia. I mean, and they're claiming they've been attacked by China in a pretty serious way. So we'll see what happens. But again, does one have any sense that Trump is convening an actual meeting of his National Security Council on this? I mean, the whole thing, whatever you think of Bolton, he would have actually had a meeting and been serious about it. I mean, it's really worrisome about the next few months of this administration.
Well, and you have that story, the cyber attack on Australia. As also earlier this week, we had the deaths on the border between India and China. And again, you can imagine a different world in which these would be major national crises. Clearly, the Chinese are taking advantage of this to flex their muscles, because as they see America isolated and distracted, they see their moment. And so, what an irony, under the slogan, Make America Great Again, we actually have made China great again. Bill Kristol, thank you so much, and stay safe and have a great weekend.
You too, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast this week. And I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.